Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Also, ladies and gentlemen, we are moving up the dial, if you're not already there, to 101.1 FM, which will be our new home. We're simulcasting for a few months, and after that, it's 101.1. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Akushla Bastable and Charlton Lee about Ghost Opera, which is a production by composer Tan Dunn. And we will also have a commentary from Ron Bloomberg. Right now, I would like to welcome Larry Ogan. He is the director of Photo Art Santa Fe and photographers Baron Wallman and Diana Block, who are taking part in this. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Larry, what is Photo Art Santa Fe?
Well, Photo Art Santa Fe is two different things. It is a biennial festival that happens that's happening this year. This happening right now as we're here sitting here on the radio. But so every 2 years we take 10 days to promote and exhibit photography and photography technology. It's an international biennial that brings in people from all over the world to experience photography here in Santa Fe, and plus bring in photographers who are from elsewhere to show their work. And plus we also produce a photo arts market, which will be held this weekend in Santa Fe, and that brings in national manufacturers from around the country to demonstrate and sell their work. And also we also will have a whole bunch of photographers, both local and national, will be there selling and showing their prints. So it's a big, exciting event. This will be the fourth time it has been produced, and we're very excited about the event.
So if people want to actually see photographs, is there one big place where there's an exhibition?
Thanks for asking. I forgot that's going to be at El Museo Cultural down in the Rail Yard Arts District. That's right. It's very close to Site Santa Fe. If you're not aware of where it's at.
So that's where everything is at right now.
No, it doesn't open until Friday night at 5 o'clock. Right now we have lectures going on, and one of your guests, Deanna, will have a lecture at the College of Santa Fe. What day is this? Tuesday.
Today is Tuesday.
I've been really busy, so I'm not sure what it is. She's Wednesday night at 6:30. And then there's also another lecture there tonight, sponsored by the New Mexico Council for Photography.
Diana Block, you are a photographer from Holland. You've come all the way to Santa Fe from Holland for this exhibition.
Yes, the very first time in Santa Fe. So it's very exciting and a fantastic event. Great city.
Your work is primarily portraiture?
No, it's been, I don't know, I guess the theater of life. It's like inner and outer theater. It's a combination of fantasy and stage. It's actually a lot of stage photography, and later combined with documentary.
I was looking at your website, which is fabulous. It's for those who want to go check it out, it's dianablock.com, and Block is spelled B-L-O-K. And there's a lot about the human body and families in all stages of life, from pregnancy to old age and everything in between.
Yeah, I think one of my research themes from the beginning was, I think, breaking through taboos, you know, and what was the naked body, what is the beauty, what is beauty, you know, what is beauty that is given to us through the commerce and television and media, and what is real beauty. So that was what I was searching, I think, for most of the time, and still do. I mean, it's like, and involving the family, yes, because they're just so close to me. I mean, they're what I have around. So it's, I guess, that simple, friends and family.
The question of beauty is something I thought about a lot when looking at your photographs, because we're so used to, when we see images in the media of bodies, they're perfect bodies and they're young mm-hmm. bodies. And in your work, there's so much else going on.
Yeah, old, young, wrinkled, not wrinkled. All stages of life, which are, I think, what we are, what we have to live through and accept. And I think part of that, part of photographing it, is also living it for me. Photography is really a mirror of, which reflects life itself to me and my teacher. It's a real guide, the camera.
When you talk about breaking taboos, some of the work that you did that really interested me was work of families. You have pictures of entire naked families, three sons and their mother, and they're holding their mother in their arms, for example, or other things that in the United States, you'd be afraid of getting arrested for even hanging this on the wall.
Yeah, it's different. Huh?
It is different. I mean, I wanted to ask you that. I mean, are things like that taboo? I would think that they're less taboo in Holland than here, but are they still taboos?
Well, I think Holland is actually gave me a lot of freedom of creativity, because I grew up in South America where taboo was very, very big. And
where in South America?
I was born in Uruguay, lived in Colombia, lived in Guatemala, lived in Mexico, and went to Europe in 1974 and stayed. So, yes, I was brought up with heavy taboos, and I felt so free when I got to Amsterdam. Everything was possible. You could go out walking 4 a.m. safely. And so that's where actually my creativity unfolded. I felt finally ready, and I knew exactly what I wanted to say. It was like it was the right time. And I think the people, the mentality there also still is today very open and...
In Holland?
Different, yes. Also even than other European countries, even though it's becoming a little in Holland, yes.
Now, I also got the impression that Holland really supports and understands its artists.
Yeah, I think for many years, through the government, Dutch government, which has been a very socialist government for many years, now also changing, now it's becoming less so and becoming more right-wing and a little bit... We're not so happy with a lot of things that are going on, but it has supported its art for many, many years. Yeah.
Now, you've done quite a bit of photography in Latin America as well.
Yeah.
When you go back there, does it feel like home? You said you were free when you went to Holland. Do you feel that freedom now when you go back to Latin America?
Yes. I mean, now, you know, I think that was a period which I had to grow through, and now it's just part of me. So wherever I am, it's the same. But I always feel like I have one foot there and one foot in Holland. It will be so all of my life, you know.
Let's turn to Baron Willman, who we've had you on the program before.
Mary Charlotte, I forgot to mention that Baron will be at the Photo Arts Market. He's one of the photographers exhibiting there, so
yes.
I want to make sure we get that in there.
Absolutely.
I would have gotten that in there for sure.
And actually, let's not forget that Diana Block will be giving a lecture at Tipton Hall tomorrow night at 6:30, and she has an exhibition of photographs at Turner Carroll Gallery at 725 Canyon Road. Baron.
I want to go see hers.
Well, you should go see hers, because the work is incredible. But we should go see yours, too. You are very famous for your work from the 60s, photographing musicians for Rolling Stone. But, you know, you've done a lot of other work besides that.
I know. People don't know me for the other work. And, I don't even tell them about it anymore. I after I did the Rolling Stone... I started a book publishing company. I learned to fly. I started doing aerial landscapes. And for more years than I actually was at Rolling Stone, I did these aerial landscapes. I did a book of Israel from the air, California from the air, Hawaii from the air, Kenya, all that stuff. But nobody remembers that. You know, they look at the... I mean, I'm very...
They look at Jimi Hendrix and Mick Jagger and Grace Slick, and they go bananas.
Exactly. And, you know, I feel blessed, and I'm very happy that I took them. The pictures, and I'm very happy that the people are in love with the musicians, because it keeps my mortgage paid. But sometimes I don't want to even put a hex on the joy that I feel for having had that opportunity. But I've done other stuff too.
Yeah, and it was a long time ago, and it's an era that's not here anymore.
Sweetheart, everything was a long time ago at my age right now.
So what are you working on now?
Actually, well, my big project is... Here's the thing. There are many of us who are over 60 who photographed the rock and roll scene and made the album covers that everybody knows and the pictures that everybody knows. And we're concentrated in the U.S. and we're concentrated in the U.K. So I'm going to do a film. We're finishing the pilot and the trailer on it. I'm going to do a film where I go to these people before they go up into that big dark room in the sky, and I talk to them about the stories behind the pictures that we know so well, because once they're gone... The stories are gone. The pictures are going to remain, but the stories, I want to catch those now. And so that's the project. And it's once the pilot's done, then I expect funding will be very easy, because everybody understands that music is so much a part of popular culture and our you know, our culture, that these stories are going to be worth keeping, kind of like a living history.
You are showing your work at...
At the Marketplace.
At the Marketplace. Yeah. What work are you? What bodies of work are you going to be showing?
What do you think?
Just the
60s. Yeah. The 60s. Well, the 60s rock and roll, sweetheart. I mean, listen,
I was looking at your aerial photography. It's great.
It is. It is. And I love it, and I'm proud of it, and it was so much fun to do because, you know, I would get in an airplane with my camera by myself, go flying around, you know, open the window, take the pictures from the window, from the airplane.
You were flying solo, taking pictures and flying the plane
exactly,
at the same time.
Exactly. And
he's a daredevil.
It was so much fun. It was the highest natural high I've ever had, continuous. I mean, mostly because you realize when you're in the airplane, you have to get down safely. So you're always a little bit at risk, you know. I was coming back from Monterey to Santa Rosa, where I was living a few years ago, and suddenly the engine quit. And it's only a single-engine plane, you know, and that was a challenge, you know, to decide what to do at that moment, because you know, you need to get the plane down. It's going to go down anyhow. But fortunately, I was close enough to an airport that I was able to land that.
So you will be at Photo Art Santa Fe, and I wanted to ask actually all of you questions, because this is not only an exhibition of the art of photography, but of the craft as well. People are going to be showing photo equipment and things like that. Do the two of you still do black and white darkroom photography? Have you gone completely over to digital, some of both?
No, I got rid of my darkroom 4 years ago. Basically because I had to move studios. Otherwise, I would have kept it. But it was... and actually, I'm very happy I don't have to be in the chemicals. I think that part for me is... And I have it done when I really want to black and white. I still work in black and white and color. But digital, yes. I'm really slowly getting into it. But I photograph my special work with... how do you call it? Analog or... Analog medium, yes.
What about you, Baron?
Well, most of the work that I did was done on film, and so most of those pictures get printed as silver gelatin or platinum prints, the real thing, not the digital prints, which, I mean, the digital prints look good, but I still don't think they're the real thing. But, you know, it brings up a really interesting point, and two things to mention. First of all, Santa Fe is a mecca for photography and photographers. I don't think there's any place in the country where that gathers photographers and photography the way this does. I mean, New York is big, LA is big, it's all commercial, but there's something about the soul of photography that is focused in Santa Fe. And that's why this Photo Art Santa Fe, this biennial, is so important, that it gathers together a whole disparate group of professionals and amateurs, which is the other thing, is that with the advent of digital photography, everybody's a photographer, and I say that it's the good news and the bad news, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
You can, amateurs can make really good pictures, you know, and because the cameras do all the work. When I was shooting, and I'm sure when you were shooting, Diane, in the beginning, you have to do light readings, there's no auto exposure, there's no auto focus, but now, you know, the camera does the work.
Yeah,
but
I think the difference between right now, we have to like specify more and more the concept of what we're doing as artists. I mean, photography, the camera is just a tool. So whether you use a pinhole or a fantastic Hasselblad, it's really about what's in your mind and soul that you want to express. And that's how we differ ourselves from any amateur which has a camera, like a washing machine.
I would agree with that with a digital camera, the people can take a lot of high-quality photographs, but they kind of what Diana is talking about, that kind of the artist's eye and how you see things. The amateur may occasionally, by accident, hit that, you know, they go, wow, that's really a great photograph. I'm now a photographer. But then there's like the, you know, there's a thousand other ones they've taken that are nothing. Whereas, you know, an artist like these two, you know, they have an eye for what they're doing, and they still maintain that vision that any artist maintains. And so whatever tool they might be using, I think it's how you use that tool that it becomes important.
Well, on the one extreme, if you're working with a camera with an 8x10 negative, let's say, or 4x5 negative, you're going to set up the shot, put a lot of work into it, expose that one negative, and maybe in a day's work do a few, you know, 5, 10, whatever. With a digital camera, you could take hundreds in the same amount of time. What's gained and what's lost?
That's a good Well, a record of your life is gained because you can just take a picture of everything that's going on all around you all the time.
Do you do that?
I do that more than I had ever done that, you know. And I look at the pictures, and I'm not proud of them, but they are records of the moment. And, you know, one thing about photography is you look back at pictures that you've taken years ago. The moment you see that picture, it triggers a memory in your mind, and you know where you were. You remember the people. You remember the environment. And so in that sense, it's you know, it's fun. I don't call it art. It's just good snapshots.
Well, I think you also become much less selective. That's the problem. So that's the bad news. It's because you can trash everything so easily. You become much more less selective, whereas with film you don't. So.
And do you find that even for yourself as a professional who's been photographing for decades?
Oh, yeah. I will take, you know, 10 of the same situation and maybe never see them again or years later. Putting it on a CD is so different than just having a contact sheet. You know, I miss my contact sheets. Although you can still do it, it's different.
Do you ever go back and look at your contact sheets from, say, 30 years ago?
Oh, yes. Right now I'm actually reprinting my archive. I have a lab who's printing it on an iris procedure, a selection of works from the 70s, well, late 70s up until now. Very slowly, but it's very interesting. Some stuff has never been printed, some negatives.
What's it like for you to look back at that time? Do you see it differently? Do you remember?
It's like a diary. It's like keeping a diary. It can get very tiring, you know, once you look at them, oh my God, you know, life, it's, you know, all this has happened and all these people have passed by and you remember their names, you remember their faces. It's like a diary. Yeah.
But the thing about digital versus analog is you see now at the market where we have the manufacturers come in, where in 2003 it was fairly geared towards analog and some digital. This year we have Apple's going to be there demonstrating their new products for their computer and to work with digital photography. So instead of it being like Kodak, we have no Kodak, but we have Apple taking the most booths of anybody. So you're seeing that trend moving that way. But also we have people that still work with the analog, and we have folks like Bostick and Sullivan who have actually deal with 19th century technology, platinum prints and all that, and they have learned how to take digital back to a process where they can create those large negatives you're talking about from digital and then do the 19th century processes. As they like to say, you know, 20th century and 21st century technology didn't work together very well. 19th century and 21st century technology is working together quite well.
Say more about that.
Well, what they're doing is taking the photographs to go into a computer, and then Kevin Sullivan has figured out a way to through Photoshop and all that to make negatives, the large, you know, he can on a printer he can print out then transparencies, which would be just be your negatives, and so he can take a 35 millimeter, he can take an image from a, you know, so he can take old, he could take, say, Diana's old, you know, some of her old 35 millimeters and get those into a computer and then create an 8x10 image for her, you know, a negative for her, and then she could go ahead and do that in, say, platinum or palladium or something like that.
Nice.
And the same with Barron's work, it all could be put on, you know, all could be taken, put into a computer, and he could begin to print it, you know, out that way. So, I mean, the two have worked together real well. So we're beginning to see, you know, and since photo art started in 2001, and just in that short amount of time, we're seeing a real shift in kind of this. It's almost like a battle between analog and digital, and yet so you're seeing the natures of them change. You know, the silver printing and all that kind of stuff is going to be, I think, more of a boutique kind of a printing. It'll be more of a handmade product. And thus, I think you can be able to command a higher price for that because it still has the artist in the dark room, the artist with their hands on more than say that on a computer.
The as you were talking about a moment ago, Deanna, the chemistry of darkroom printing is toxic to humans and the environment. I mean, I imagine a lot of people are happy to see it go.
Well, for me particularly, it was, because I got a really bad allergy in my hands. You know, I worked with it for many, many years, and at a certain point I just got, you know, and it was really hard to heal, and it did. So, you know, it depends. Some people, it's like painters, some people never feel anything from the acrylics and all the effects of turpentine and so forth. But others do. So for me, it's very positive to be able to switch. And otherwise, you know, have other people do it, which make beautiful platinum or silver prints.
Has the technology, we're talking about digital technology for taking pictures. What about for printing? Has the technology of printing evolved quite a lot in the last few years?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really funny. Some of the digital prints that are made now, they say, this looks as good as a silver print. You won't be able to tell the difference between this digital print and a silver gelatin print. Which is not true. On the other hand, the prints are beautiful. There's no question about it, you know. I don't know why my prejudice is still for the old stuff, for the platinum prints, for the silver gelatin prints. I call them the real ones. I call the digital ones the others, you know. But it's not fair because people are doing a lot of creative work with the new printers, and the papers are constantly being developed, and the inks are being developed, and they're making. I mean, it's art. There's no question. The images are hugely artistic.
In Europe, we're also working a lot just with a personal operator. You know, so we sit on the computer with one person who's sensitive to your works. I mean, definitely that's like a must for me and for every other artist. And it's actually like the darkroom. You select piece by piece what you want, darken it, lighten it. So it's similar. It's just a whole new way of seeing. And
so instead of burning and dodging and all that stuff in the darkroom, you are working with a technician and saying...
No, you burn and dodge on the computer.
On the computer.
And that's why they call it a digital darkroom, because you're doing some of the same processes. Actually, spotting the images on a computer is so much easier than spotting...
Or retouching.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you just... fill in pixels. Yeah.
This is the kind of demonstrations and things workshops you'll be seeing at the market is demonstrations of new papers and how to work with your monitor better and how to use these new products. I mean, they're developing new products very quickly now. It's happening very fast. And so that's the kind of thing you're going to be seeing is how to take digital to that level where it can have that feel of a handmade product like we have with photography in the analog and in the darkroom processes.
Of course, the challenge is still to make a living at photography. The photo schools are just churning out photographers right and left. There's so many photo schools in this country that are creating, and it's hard. How do you make a living at this wonderful art that you're doing? You know, any of us. That's a huge challenge.
I agree. I teach in the Royal Academy in Holland, in The Hague, photography, fine arts photography, and I see the same problem. I mean, we're turning out 30 a year, and the first year students are 60. 60 start every year, and that's only one academy out of the six. So it's, I also don't know. I don't know how they're going to, survive.
I get phone calls from artists who moved to Santa Fe, and they say, I've just got my master's degree. I'm moving to Santa Fe. What gallery should I sign up for? And I go, well, you should come here and, check out what galleries you think you fit into, but do you have any other skills?
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah.
Don't quit
are you
your
a good waiter or a good waitress? Can you cook,
Don't quit your day job, as they say. Here in Santa Fe, I mean, you must get a lot of photographers in Photo Arts Santa Fe, et cetera, who are trying to photograph the beautiful landscape here.
Well, that is the tradition here. I mean, I've always said that when photography was invented, my theory is that some of the first cameras came down the old Santa Fe Trail to Santa Fe. So that would be around, 1866, whenever photography was actually, around there when it was invented. So, yeah, this is a very, just a very photographic place, the whole state. And so you've had some of the most famous photographs in the world have been shot here. If you look at Moonrise Over Hernandez by Ansel Adams.
Mm-hmm. In fact,
just up the road.
Here. So Photo Arts Santa Fe is happening going through July 22nd. The website is photoartssantafe.com. What else do you want to tell us before we go?
Well, if they need a schedule of events, they're in the new The Magazine, the Sun That Stands Now, and they can pick up The Magazine. There's an insert of all the scheduled events that are taking place, and there's still a lot going on, even though it's already started. There's a lot going on this week and then next weekend, so they can pick that schedule up there, or it is on the website.
And Baron Woolman is at baronwoolman.com, Diana Block, Diana BLOK.com. We are spelling for our listeners out there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break right now and hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg and from some of our underwriters, and then we will be back talking about Ghost Opera in just a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. As I'm sure you know by now, we are currently broadcasting simultaneously on 90.7 and 101.1. That's a stronger signal, and we're getting a lot of really nice calls from people who have never heard us before. There's another one. It just won't stop. Hello.
Patio furniture, please.
Excuse me?
Is this Home Depot?
No, this is a radio station.
Which one?
KSFR.
Never heard of you.
Where do you live?
I don't give my address out, pal.
Generally, where do you live?
On the outskirts of Albuquerque.
Well, you can now hear us on 101.1.
Who are you?
Ron Bloomberg is my name.
The mayor of New York?
That's Michael Bloomberg. I'm the voice in the crowd.
I hate crowds.
It's not a real crowd.
What is it? Some kind of subversive, radical, nutso crowd?
Look, why don't you go to your radio, put on 101.1. You'll hear interesting talk shows, great jazz, award-winning news.
All right. I'll turn it on when I go for my patio furniture.
Wonderful.
May I just say one thing?
Sure.
Do yourself a favor. Stay out of crowds. There's a lot of streptococci going around.
Okay. And I'll talk to you next week, simultaneously, if you have a minute.
And we're back with Akushla Bastable and Charlton Lee. Akushla is the director, and Charlton is one of the performers in Ghost Opera, which is playing tonight and tonight only at the Lenzic. It's a performance. Well, Ghost Opera is a composition by composer Tan Dunn, who is also the composer of the opera Tea, A Mirror of Soul, which is at the Santa Fe Opera this whole summer. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Ghost Opera, it's very interesting work. It's a work with five performers, instrumentalists, a string quartet plus one. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhere between a musical concert and a theater piece.
It is, yeah.
Tell us more about it.
Well, I think that Tandon himself thinks very visually. So as a composer, he creates spatially as well. So he had ideas about the positions that the performers would go to. So the string quartet and the pipa player, they sort of have this dialogue between these spaces. And part of the reason for that is because it's a piece that moves between time and spiritual realms. So, and that's the concept behind it. The idea of the ghosting, if you like, is that the performers, one of which is the wonderful Charlton sitting to my left, is that they invoke the spirits of past, from the past, and spirits of possible future, and so we have Bach that's invoked, Shakespeare's invoked, and then through a Chinese folk song, the spirit of this child's parents who've died are also invoked. So there's a number of things going on, and the performers, in a way, are the way I've been talking to them is they're kind of like shamans and magicians, and they sort of conjure these things. And Charlton is a very good conjurer.
Is this the first time that Charlton that you've played this work?
Oh yeah, this is the very first time, and I hope it's not the last. We certainly would like to do it again. It's been a fantastic ride here.
The piece was composed and premiered, 13 years ago, something like that?
1994?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, it was 1994.
And so written for the Kronos Quartet.
It was for the Kronos Quartet.
And the performer Wu Man, who is playing tonight.
Yes, correct. And she toured with them actually for about 3 years. She toured with them with this piece, and she's performed it with other people. This is her first time to perform it with the Del Sol Quartet. So,
tell us about the Del Sol Quartet. This is a string quartet.
Right. We're based in San Francisco, and we are primarily a new music ensemble. Our focus has been music from North and South America, and more recently we've expanded into kind of a Pacific Rim theme, and we'll probably continue work eastward until we wind up back here in America.
You go through China and then Russia, Central
right.
Europe, and
exactly. People recently have been asking us, are you playing any European music? Is it, well, we'll get back to that soon.
Yeah.
So we're going to hear, actually, why don't we hear some of the music right now from Ghost Opera? Let's start at the beginning and hear the beginning of the first movement.
Great. And so this is just the beginning of the first movement of Ghost Opera, which is tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lenzik. So it starts with the sound of water. Water is an instrument. It's a part of the music of this piece.
There are three large bowls, about 3.5 feet across or so, and they're filled with water. And we're, throughout the piece, there are moments where we're playing sort of with the water, with our hands, and then also with these, you heard those very eerie type of screaming sounds.
That's ghost sounds.
Those that sound is made by a gong that we use a bow to play. And so you're drawing the bow across the gong, which gives it that really incredible sort of eerie screaming sound. And then we're dipping it into the water, which creates this pitch variation. Mm-hmm. It's visually also a very beautiful thing to see.
It's quite a, if not a stretch, certainly an adventure for a viola player or a regular string quartet player, no?
I think we're used to playing very unusual pieces and using a lot of extended techniques. The element of movement within the piece, and because we're moving from station to station as well, so it's extremely theatrical, and it's been just fantastic working with the Kushlov because she's a stage person, and being able to direct us and give us ideas and techniques even about being on stage, movement, and there's vocalizations as well throughout the piece.
As we heard a little touch of so far already.
A little touch of as well, yeah. It's really a multi-dimensional type of piece, and it really hits a lot more senses than just sound.
Akushla, it's interesting for you to be directing what is primarily a music piece. You're mm-hmm. a theater director. How do you do it?
With humility. No, because they are fantastic, and I deeply respect the fact that it's a multimedia piece, really. And so what my interaction is on the level where the music intersects with the theatricality, with the sense for me, which is deeply important as an artist, the sense of ritual, and then in terms of vocalization, I've been helping them with that as well. Tandon really, as I said, conceives very visually, and so he creates instruments, if you like. He creates instruments that work both aurally and visually. So the bowl, the concept with the bowl and watching the performers dip the gong and then bow the gong is a physical act, you know. So you can't remain sort of, you know, often with musicians we think of string quartets, we think of something that's quite closed in and it's, you know, it's quite intimate. And this is dramatic and big. You have to do that in order just to make the sounds right, everything, you know. So it's very physical, which I have really, really enjoyed. And we've added in this, we've added to this the element of video. Because some of what they're doing is just so exquisite, and to see it up close is really fun and fabulous. And also,
so you're sitting in the Lensic watching the performers on stage, and there's video cameras live that, and you see big images of, say, their hands or the mm-hmm. way they're playing.
Yes, absolutely. And then we also have some pre-recorded, so we have some abstracted elements too. We're sort of mixing the two. It's pre-recorded and live.
And so what's it like for you, Charlton, to be moving on the stage almost as an actor?
He is an actor.
Well, I think we're transferring some of our performance concepts to visuals, from sound to visual. So it's a kind of a translation. And we're not as familiar to do that with our bodies, but I think the concept is not unfamiliar. It's still performance, but it's just we're...
And also, Charlton does a lot of Tai Chi, and is also actually a very natural performer. So it's really easy. So I just sort of say to him, so I want to make you to make that big, and he just gets it immediately and enjoys it. And I think that's what a performer does; they enjoy that. So it may not be a territory in which they roam all the time, but they're really, I cannot tell you how incredible it's been to work with them, because they're just so open to everything, and they want to do it. So, and that's a big thing, because musicians are often, you know, classical musicians, you don't, they just come from a very different place. These guys are just, they're rock stars. So.
Now, I was wondering, I was at the rehearsal yesterday watching you guys playing this piece, and thinking, is it possible to play this piece from the sheet music, or do you have to have heard a recording of it?
Oh, no, you can. It's all there in the sheet music.
Is it? Because, I mean, I was thinking with the drops of water and some of these sounds, which I don't even know how you could write them on notes. I mean, the sound of a bowed gong being dipped in water, that can be written down?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Really?
I mean, it's not that strict. So there's a lot of, there are sections of the piece where it's largely improvisatory. He'll write elements of either just note fragments or rhythmic fragments that we continue to play at our own pacing according to how we hear everybody else is playing. So that, I mean, the gong, it would be just like a wavy line, you know, something like this.
And you'll see some of that, because we have captured some of the score, and it will be on the video. Because for me, also as a non-musician, I was fascinated by how you graphically write that, and some of the graphic notation that turned on. And the scores that we have are handwritten, so it's a very intimate. I mean, he's an incredible man. He actually came in yesterday and was working with us a little bit, and will work with us again this morning. He's a very wonderful, wonderful composer, and just has a lovely vision. And because he's created these sections that are improvisatory, there's this lovely freedom and this lovely connection that happens between the performers, as with any improvisation, because it's very much in the moment. So it's wonderful. And Wu Man is incredible, a really an amazing pipa player.
Well, let's talk about that. Would you like to talk about that instrument, the pipa? What is it?
It's a traditional Chinese instrument, and it's a little bit like a lute or an oud, the same family. And she's one of the best in the world.
And there are moments, actually, if Marilyn can cue up the last section there at 1843, there's moments where it sounds almost like a mandolin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, she has a technique. Well, you'd have to see it, or you might be able to hear it with her when she's doing these tremolo sounds, and where her fingers are just going.
We capture that on video,
it's
too.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
You'll see it
really
tonight.
It's a phenomenal type of technique. You never see it on guitar or anything else.
No.
It's just a really special technique.
And so this is, I mean, when you have an instrument like that, which I guess is probably traditionally played in China, there probably aren't very many people in other parts of the world who do it. I mean, she's one of the premier players.
I think it's spreading.
Mm-hmm.
at least in California and San Francisco, there are a lot of people teaching these types of instruments. The popularity, I think, is growing. I don't know how many people are... The problem, of course, is you have to have good teachers for it to really begin to move around. But I think we're seeing more of it. We're seeing a lot of them in concert. They seem to be extremely popular in Europe as well, Chinese instruments. A lot of traditional Chinese instrumentalists have immigrated to Europe, and they seem to be performing a lot there.
And what I love about it as well is that it can be so gentle and lyrical and sweet, and then it has this harshness as well. It's just the range is quite interesting, isn't it?
There's a heavy metal element.
Yeah, that's right, because everything is electrified.
It's so good.
Let's hear just that little clip right now, just to give people a taste of one of the sounds of this instrument. So that was just a little moment of it, but it's just such an amazing sound, an amazing range of sounds. Charlton, I wanted to ask you, you're Asian American, did you grow up listening to, playing Asian music, Chinese music?
Not so much. I it was around, and so I grew up speaking Chinese at home, but I was trained from the age of 7 in Western European classical tradition.
And you play the viola?
I play the viola. And so it's, I think it still is very familiar to me, just because there would always be the occasional performer that my parents would take me to that had come from China or Taiwan, or we would go see a Chinese opera production. And so it was always around, but not heavily present. But I feel like it's in my blood.
In your blood somehow.
Yeah.
Kushla, the ghost, let's go back to the whole theme of ghost opera. What is the traditional ghost opera, Chinese ghost opera, on which this is based? I mean, here you're invoking Shakespeare and Mozart or Bach or whatever, but originally, were pieces like this intended to actually invoke ghosts?
Well, I think he talks about musical rituals that were created and using improvised instruments, by the way, too, pots and pans, and he's very much inspired by that. But to send spirits to send people into the next realm as well is an element of that. But then also, it's for me, I kind of connected in to Western traditions. It's like the day, it isn't quite the Day of the Dead, but in the way that the Day of the Dead celebrates the dead, there's a sense that in these traditions the dead are celebrated, so the spirits of those, and so they're invoked, but then they're celebrated. So it's celebratory as well as being sort of a ritual. And these ghosts, they would incorporate dance and music and and text and all of those things, because they were quite rural, and so it's like it's a peasant tradition. So it's not like it's we're not looking at Peking opera here. We're sort of looking at something that's coming out of from the people themselves.
Exactly.
So it's the other end. But he draws on that very much, because what's important to consider in this piece is that we have the string quartet and we have the pipa, and so in a way they're traditional instruments from both, from west and east, and then we also have these other elements, and they are considered instruments. So the element of water, the element of paper, stone, metal, so the gong is made of, so there are these elemental things, and the elemental things course right through the whole piece, and in fact the piece starts, emerges out of the elements, and really returns back into them. And one thing we've been talking quite a lot about in this piece is Prospero, because there are pieces from Shakespeare's The Tempest that are very specifically The Tempest that's in this. And as we know, Prospero is on a magical island and controls all the spirits and sprites. and he's also able to he also controls the elements, so he causes the storm at the beginning of the tempest. And to me, that is what these guys are doing in the beginning. Kate, who is the first violinist, is playing water, and she's invoking. She draws them in. So when Charlton starts playing, he starts playing a little section from Bach. But it's because he's been sort of invoked, you know. So there's this thing that happens, and then it returns to the elements at the very end as well. We have this sense that all of these things, because in the Tempest, she talks about this insubstantial pageant will fade, and so all of what we've seen just sort of, you know, melts and dissolves into this elemental structure. So that's the way I've been thinking about it.
I just want to say, make a comment about the last little section that we heard. He's combining that at that point, this Chinese folk song, with Bach.
Right.
And he hasn't changed any notes, I don't believe. And it's just perfectly laid together, and you create this completely new type of sound together.
And yeah. All of this is Ghost Opera by composer Tan Dun, which is tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic, presented by the Santa Fe Opera. It was so interesting also, you know, the rest of the public gets to see the performance, but, you know, we get to go see the rehearsal, and it feels sometimes like you're building a living being out of dust and clay. I mean, all the lighting people are at one end, and the directors are here, and the performers are all rehearsing, and then suddenly something comes together. Have you gotten to that point yet, or does it only happen the first time you actually perform it on stage?
I think the magic only happens the first time on stage.
Hopefully we'll have all the elements in place. We've got an interesting morning ahead of us. So, I mean, it's a hard turnaround because it's a short piece. It's what, 38 minutes long, just under 40. And yet it's so, I mean, I think it's so detailed. It's moment to moment. He both composes like that. And personally, that's the way I like to work anyway. So, and there's just so many gorgeous pictures that we were creating together, and because he's created such an amazing fabric with which to work, you know, and he's really open because as I say, he conceives visually of things. I was nervous in the beginning about incorporating other elements, so I've added stuff, I've added movement for them that they weren't doing before. But he came in yesterday and he was really happy, so he said, oh, it's wonderful. So he's, and he will also introduce the show tonight.
Tan Dun, the composer. Yeah. And so all of this is tonight at the Lenzic. Akushla, you just very briefly, because we've got less than a minute left, but what other projects are you working on these days? Are you doing any other theater in New Mexico?
Not right now. I am actually building a new piece, which I'm building with a good friend of mine, a composer, and then with some fabulous people down in Albuquerque, and some actors from Norway and Ireland. But that's sort of in a very early developmental stage. But tomorrow I leave. I'm doing a project in Italy, so I go to Italy tomorrow. And then back here, and then I work with the opera as an educator too. So when we have a student produced opera program, so I work with them too.
And Charlton Lee, you are with the Del Sol String Quartet, which plays all over the world.
Well, slowly.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Akushla Bastable, director, and Charlton Lee, performer in Ghost Opera by composer Tan Dun, tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic, presented by the Santa Fe Opera. The number is 988-1234. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can even subscribe to the show on iTunes. We are moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. If you haven't retuned your radio, go to 101.1, and you can be heard. We can be heard actually further throughout northern New Mexico than ever. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Many thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Tomorrow, even though it's not Black History Month, we're going to be doing a kind of a Black History Hour with both musical and historical elements. So all that and much, much more on Santa Fe's public radio station, KSFR. Hasta mañana. Ciao.